It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. We supply to the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho honestly provocative radio on a daily basis. Well, Monday through Friday. And we want to invite you to the conversation as well. If you'd like to take part in the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every single day. And we're live throughout all three of those states on 25 great radio affiliates here in the Pacific Northwest. I want to start with a Twitter poll because it gets to something that I'm going to tell you. Now, I think the public schools have become a toxic cesspool in many, many ways. But let me get you the specific information on that. And I don't think, I may get a naysayer on this, but if anybody thinks that kids who are playing games involving slave trade on social media and a staff member chooses to show up at a public school here in the Northwest wearing blackface, if anybody doesn't think that is a toxic environment, I'd love to hear the naysayer call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. We are going to be talking about the Gabby Petito case. It's a national case of interest, and there's a real question about the role that his parents have been playing in perhaps shielding a man who may well have taken the life of his girlfriend, his fiance. We're going to get to that later on this hour. But our Twitter poll, just to start you off, should Northwest states give parents and students choice when it comes to public schooling? That is, if you want to send your kids to the bricks and mortar government schools that have failed so many children recently and have been failing them for decades in what the kids are getting taught and what they don't get taught, should the money follow the child so that the parent and the child can make the decision? Do I want conventional government failed schools? Do I want a magnet school? Do I want online learning? Do I want a private school, maybe even a parochial school? Do I want a public charter school? Do I want a private charter school? Or traditional schools. There is a huge amount of research. Real Clear Opinion Research poll released this summer found that 74% of registered voters now support school choice. That is, giving parents the right to use the tax dollars designated for their child's education to send their child to public or private school or whatever best suits their needs. I'm in favor of it. I've been telling you that literally for decades on this show. It now turns out that almost 3/4 of registered voters are in favor of it, too. I would vote yes. Northwest State should give parents and students choice when it comes to public schools. You can find the Twitter poll online at Lars Larson Show, also at LarsLarson.com if you can't stand Twitter. And a lot of us cannot stand Twitter. That's one of the reasons we're making the move to Getter. We still have a presence on Twitter. It's a bit of a toxic cesspool as well. But we're on Getter now at Lars Larson. And, of course, you can find us on Facebook, although Facebook likes to censor people just about as much as Twitter does. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, I want to start with a couple of major indictments. Something is terribly, terribly wrong in our public schools. And let me give you the latest evidence. It kind of took me aback this morning when I saw the notice from one Northwest school district. In this case, it's Newburgh Public Schools. They've had some wins and they've had some losses. A little over a month ago, the school district board of directors voted and said, we want all politics out of the classroom. I found that laudatory. I found that fantastic. Really, you're going to take out all those crazy political flags and leave just one, the flag of the United States of America. I think that most of us can get together on the fact that the United States flag should be present in public schools. But they said, get rid of the Black Lives Matter flag and the gay rights flags and all these other things that bring politics to the classroom. Well, this morning, I got notice that the Newburgh Public Schools, which is now reconsidering its vote to get politics out of the classroom, you understand if they let politics in, it will not be conservative politics. It won't be NRA. It won't be Right to Life. It's only going to be the left-wing garbage that gets shoved at them. Well, now, Now they've got a school district staff member who's been placed on leave, worked at an elementary school, and showed up wearing blackface. Apparently, it had something to do with the fact that the teacher, it appears to be a teacher, could be a teacher's aide, was protesting the vaccine mandates and had made himself or herself, we don't know which, up to look like Rosa Parks. Listen, there are an awful lot of public figures over the decades who are recognizable public figures. I don't know that most people, if you showed them a picture of Rosa Parks, who did some admirable things, although there's a lot of politics involved in that case as well, that had to do with the fact that she wasn't the first person to object to the crazy policies of those communities that said that black citizens would be treated inappropriately by the public bus system. And it was the public bus system, the one run by government, that was screwed up with all those rules. Most of the private bus systems that served the southern part of the United States did not have those crazy rules, and that's a little detail that's often left out. But in this case, we now find out our friends at KGW, which is the NBC television affiliate, report this teacher or this staff member has been placed on leave after showing up to work in blackface last Friday. And then on top of that, they find out that some of the kids were involved in a social media group called, believe it or not, Slave Trade, in which they joked about how much participants would pay to buy their black classmates in a slave auction. This stuff is all offensive. It is disgusting. But it suggests that there is a real cesspool of crazy politics going on in public schools. Do you think then that it might make sense to say, let's get all the politics and the critical race theory and all this other woke nonsense, let's get it out of the classroom, all the sexual politics as well? But no, they don't want to do that. And one other thing I want to let you know about, Seattle is now talking about spending $50 million additional dollars on police. No, perish the thought. They're already spending $250 million between Seattle and King County. They're spending it on the so-called homeless. And the mayor, just a couple of hours ago, Jenny Durkan, announced she wants to spend another $50 million on the homeless. There are about 10,000 homeless in Seattle. There are about 5,000 homeless on the streets in Portland. Between the two cities, they're going to be spending close to $500 million every single year, and they don't make the problem better. And now the city council in Portland, day after tomorrow, is going to consider adopting a report that says all those riots, all the looting, all the burning, all the assaults last year, you know, the Antifa BLM riots, they were not the fault of Antifa and BLM. They were the fault of the police. And here the mayors are saying, we want to get more cops on the streets. Great. Perfect way to do it, by blaming them for the riots that were carried out by the folks like Antifa and BLM and other activist groups. You're going to have a tough time hiring any cops, let alone cops that are actually able to do the job. Coming up in a moment, Taliban Joe has been letting illegals cross our borders by the hundreds of thousands, but we still have Americans trying to get out of Afghanistan. Predator drone missiles have killed 7 kids under Joe Biden. My commentary and your calls coming up next.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
If you even thought that electing a candidate who ran for president from his basement was a terrific idea, consider where we stand today. President Joe Biden has a dozen different crises, at least by my count, and no clue whatsoever how to fix them, at least in part because Joe Biden created most of them. 12,000 Haitian illegal aliens camped out under a freeway bridge between Mexico and Texas. And now we hear taxpayers have to buy their airline tickets to get them home. America's exit from Afghanistan has turned into a terrible tragedy, with 14 killed in our military and Americans still stuck on the ground in Kabul today. Inflation has been ramping up, battering Americans here at home. And remember the rap on Trump? Yeah, Donald Trump, he ruined America's reputation with all our friends around the world. Well, Joe Biden, last week, tail end of the week, managed to tick off the French by cutting them out of a big nuclear sub-deal with absolutely no warning whatsoever. Oh, and Joe dropped that Predator drone missile, the one that landed on a target in Afghanistan. We heard the White House, right after they dropped the missile, brag that it had taken out two high-value terrorists. And a lot of us said, well, great, what are their names? And the White House said, we don't know what their names were. What? Now it turns out that what actually got blown up was a humanitarian aid worker, his family, and seven little kids. Good going, Joe. Joe's agenda on Capitol Hill, trillions in new spending and trillions in new taxes to pay for it, seems to have stalled out, even though the Democrats still hold a majority in both the House and the Senate. And Joe's approval ratings are now in the basement, right back where Joe started. From Twitter, Jack Posobiec points out the Biden administration has now condemned the recent Russian election because of a lack of transparency where millions of votes were suddenly added overnight that wiped out the opposition. Gee, I don't know. How about you? That sounds kind of familiar to me. I don't know. I'll figure it out later on today. Our question of the day, I want to find the backstory of the person who showed up at Newburgh Public School wearing blackface. The statement from the district, last Friday, one of our employees reported for work in blackface. The employee was removed from the location, and Human Resources has placed the employee on administrative leave. The administration of Newburgh Public Schools, of course, here's the standard part of the copy, condemns all expressions of racism. Even though they say BLM flags, they want those to be okay. Blackface has no place in our schools. I agree with that. And we are committed to work to create spaces where every student belongs as we move forward together in the mission of educating students. Well, that, and if critical race theory comes back, they'll be telling your kids to evaluate each other and their teachers based on the color of their skin. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, today's Daily Grill was suggested by Robert Gust. He wrote to me and said, Lars, I currently work for the Oregon Department of Human Services. I've been with the state government 18 years. Critical race theory is being pushed where I work. I've filed two formal complaints as instructed by the mandatory discrimination and harassment in the workplace training. Leadership has refused to send it up to HR and has failed to meet their legal obligation as stated in mandatory training. I have all the emails and the responses from the individual I sent the complaint to. The complaints come on the heels of a racist PowerPoint presentation pointed directly at whites and calling them all kinds of derogatory names. Let me know if you'd like to see the PowerPoint. Of course, I emailed back and said, I'd love to see the PowerPoint. I'd love to put it up on Twitter and our website and everywhere else. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online at RiverCityUSA.com/careers. Jim Altman writes in, Lars, I watched the Seattle football game at home yesterday. I was surprised to see the stands were about 110% full and hardly anyone wearing masks. Didn't the governor mandate masks for crowds of more than 500? I've never been a fan of the masks, and I defy the rule as much as I can. When is enough enough? The mask thing is a joke, especially for the vaccinated or people who are immune because they've already been exposed to COVID. Maybe now's the time to revisit the governor's mandate. Is the state open or closed under the mandates? Love to hear the discussion, signed Jim Altman. Jim, I'd have to agree with you. I think most of these mandates are more than a little bit silly. Fact is, a lot of other countries around planet Earth have said if you've already had the disease, you don't have to worry about getting vaccinated. In the United States, and especially in states like Oregon and Washington, not so very much. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's go to Ron in Tacoma. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I think maybe we might be winning the fight of insanity versus sanity.
Really?
I got kicked off the internet yesterday for putting a post on the news bulletin reference Australia fighting back over COVID.
Yeah.
and a gentleman had posted, because they were talking about taking their guns, what's left of them. And he made a comment saying, you should take all their guns. And I said, yep, take all their guns. Canadians are too stupid to be armed. And I got kicked off the internet. So it looked like...
That's just an opinion, isn't it? I mean, look, I like Canadians. I mean, I'm kind of sad the border is more or less closed at this point. My wife and I have loved going up into British Columbia, going up to Vancouver, or going up to Victoria, or going up to Lake Louise and Banff and places like that. We usually do it as a road trip. It's too much hassle to fly. But no, I don't think, you know, but all you said was an insult, and you got kicked off Twitter. What did they say your great offense was?
They said the post taken off for 7 days is against their standards.
What standard? I mean, time I checked, does Facebook actually have any standards? Because there's plenty of stuff on there that I find offensive, but I don't ask for it to be kicked off.
Yeah, I'm confused on this. Somehow that hate speech, I don't see it. I would like to know what I know. The upset thing I'm about here is that I'm kicked off for 7 days. Again, and I don't know, is this legal?
Yes, it's legal, but here's the difference. Facebook and Twitter are supposed to be platforms. That is, they can take you down if you threaten to kill somebody, or you say, I'm going to post the recipe for making a bomb or plans for making an atomic bomb. I mean, stuff that's just dangerous. On the other hand, you should be able to say anything you want. But clearly, both Facebook and Twitter are driven by left-wing politics. They don't like right-wingers like you or me, and they're going to kick you off. Meantime, both of them, I know Twitter is still allowing the mad mullahs of Tehran, the folks who run Iran, to go on and wish for the death of the United States and the death of Israel and all the rest of that stuff. They like most liberals, have double standards, or they wouldn't have any standards at all. Coming up in a moment, the disappearance of Gabby Petito, her supposed fiancé, Brian Laundrie. Laundrie has now disappeared, and his parents were shielding him. Will that get them in legal trouble? We'll talk about it with our go-to prosecutor in a moment. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. There's a story we've been watching here on the show. Haven't talked about it every day, but it has to do with two people. Gabby Petito, whose body was apparently found over the weekend. The coroner will finish identifying that a bit later. The autopsy is scheduled for today. And then Brian Laundrie, her supposed fiancé. The two of them had been traveling in the western United States. They'd gone to places like Yosemite. They'd gone to Wyoming. And Gabby Petito was last seen alive on the 24th of August. And after that, her mother kept getting some text messages, but very short ones, saying, service is really bad here, Mom, like the one that came on the 30th of August. And then her boyfriend turns up back in Florida, the whole country away, and shows up at his mom and dad's house, and then won't talk to the cops. Now, both of these people are adults. He won't talk to the cops. Parents won't talk to the cops. And then at the tail end of last week, it turns out that Brian Laundrie had disappeared and was driving one of the family's cars, dropped it in a big nature preserve, and then left. We don't know if he left to perhaps take his own life, to try to escape. But I wanted to explore one piece of this, and I know some other pieces of this are going to come up. I think it's probably relatively simple to solve. Gabby Petito's body, it appears, has been found. If I had to guess who's most likely responsible for her demise, it's her former fiancé, Brian Laundrie. But the question I want to put to DA Josh Marquis, now a former DA, but with a lot of experience, 40 years of experience as a prosecutor, Josh, how far can parents go in shielding an adult child before they themselves cross the line and become criminals?
Well, adult parents have absolutely no special rights over adult children in terms of protecting them that they might have with juvenile children or doctors or priests. There's no special relationship. There are some defense attorneys that have argued there should be some. So they cannot, in Oregon at least, and different laws have different states, there's a crime called hindering prosecution, which is where you knowingly conceal or harbor someone to prevent their apprehension or discovery by police. So it's one thing for them to just say, we don't want to talk to you about it.
They're committing a crime there.
But willfully misleading the police, I mean, I've prosecuted a number of cases like this. Only one or two were murders. Most of them involved much more mundane things. The ones I remember are cops knocking on the door and saying, where's your boyfriend? And the girl says, I have no idea. He's literally in the closet. And that's hindering prosecution in Oregon, or it's a felony. You can go to prison for it. And there are similar laws in most of the United States.
But in this case, the story we hear is that on the 1st of September, the police seize this van that the two of them had been traveling around in. It happened to be the property, not of Brian Laundrie, but of his now late fiance, Gabby Petito. He had shown up in Florida on the 1st of September, at least by the 1st of September, the police seized the vehicle. They then said, we want to talk to him. And the parents said, we don't want to talk to you, and he doesn't want to talk to you. And they have the right under the Fifth Amendment to say, we're not going to talk to the cops, right?
That's true, although in terms of the Fifth Amendment, that's the right not to incriminate yourself. You have no right not to incriminate somebody else. So, for example, what would normally happen is if authorities thought the parents knew something and they didn't want to talk, you'd convene a grand jury, haul them in, grant them immunity if you're confident that they had nothing to do with the actual crime, and force them under penalty of perjury to tell you. But, of course, the defendant or the suspect has an absolute right to just say, I'm not talking to you.
Now, we don't know what's happened to Brian Laundrie. We don't know if he's run or if he went out in that nature preserve perhaps to end his own life. We don't know. At this point, it could be any of the above, although he left a note with the car saying, please return the car to my family. But that doesn't tell you one way or the other what he was planning to do. But I think he's the A number one suspect in the disappearance of his now late fiance, Gabby Petito. So let me ask you this. He comes to his parents' house. I guess I ask myself the moral question. If the circumstances seem to indicate, you know, your son shows up, he won't tell you what happened to his girlfriend. He's driving her van. There are stories that she's disappeared somewhere and was last seen thousands of miles away. I think there's a moral obligation. I mean, blood is thick. But when you say, would you protect a family member by simply allowing them to stay at your house and answering the door and saying, we don't want to talk to the cops, would you protect somebody if the circumstances seem to indicate the person either was involved in the demise of a young lady or was even directly responsible for it? Either way, if he knows something, he should say something. And yet this family said, nope, we're not talking and he's not talking.
I agree. It's morally reprehensible, and it may even, depending on how much the family knows, it may even be legally more than just reprehensible. It may even constitute a crime. The question is, how much do they know? And again, they can say, we don't want to talk to you, and they can't be compelled with the exception I talked about.
The grand jury.
And I've done it where you convene a grand jury and haul them in front of the grand jury and say, okay, well, I'm going to invoke the Fifth. I'm waiving the Fifth. You can't be prosecuted for this. Answer my questions now. Then their choice is whether to commit perjury in front of the grand jury or refuse to testify. That's a guaranteed jail sentence, or tell the truth.
Because the judge can say you're in contempt of court for refusing to testify and you're going to jail, and you can sit. I mean, judges have held witnesses for months or years for refusing to testify.
Well, generally, the judge can hold them as long as the grand jury's in session, which varies in state to state from 1 month to a year. And if that isn't enough and the case hasn't been resolved, then you convene a new grand jury, bring the person back in front of that. And there have been stories, cases, mostly what I would call prisoners of conscience, new reporters who wanted to protect sources, who've stayed in jail rather than. But there are also people who say, I don't want to talk about, my child or my ex-wife or whatever. Now, the danger for the prosecutor is you don't want to give immunity to somebody who may have been involved in the crime.
But right.
The facts of this situation do not seem to indicate that they would have been involved in the offense.
Now, if Brian Laundrie had showed up at mom and dad's house and he's driving his girlfriend's van and she's nowhere to be seen and he either won't tell them what happened or tells them, yeah, we got in a fight and bad things happened. If he says to them, hey, I need to clean up the van, because that the van appears to be one of the only things you might find other than the scene where they found the body over the weekend, where there might be evidence of that crime. If mom and dad help him out with that, or say do his laundry and add a little extra bleach to all of his clothing, would that cross the line?
As the burden would be on the prosecution to prove that they reasonably knew that they were essentially covering up evidence of a crime. They wouldn't have to necessarily know exactly what the crime was. I mean, there could be that there was a fight, you know, and he pushed her and she slipped on a rock and fell down a ravine. Now, that's not murder, but it's still a crime.
And in fact, if he had done that, say they had a fight, he pushes her, she falls. He never intended for her to fall. But then he doesn't go seek any kind of assistance at all and simply leaves the scene. You had a manslaughter case just like that, where, oh, my wife fell off this cliff, and I didn't go summon help until hours later. Is there?
He didn't summon help ever. I mean, in many ways, the case is very similar. The woman's name was Linda Stangle. It was in 1996. She pushed her boyfriend, David Wall, off a 300-foot cliff on the Oregon coast, and then returned to Wall's parents' house in Portland, which is about 70 miles away, and said, "I lost David," to which their parents said, "What are you talking about?" She wouldn't say. We didn't find David Wall's body till 6 months later, by which point she'd moved back to Minnesota. We indicted her for and convicted her for manslaughter in a trial that got great notoriety because it was broadcast first on Court TV and then on Dateline.
Well, I got to tell you something. I think Brian Laundry has some explaining, and that's assuming he's still around and hasn't successfully escaped. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to
Local 129, Sonny.
Unions. Lars is not a fan.
These are your union representatives.
Americans who want to give up their paychecks to fat union bosses should have that right.
What if we don't want to join?
It's a union shop. You want to work, you join.
But workers should have the right to work without joining the union.
This is your union.
Here's Lars Larson.
For your own protection.
With the union update.
You gotta join that one big union.
I got to tell you something. I know that I get a lot of heat from people who say, well, you hate unions. And I said, well, I just don't like what they do to people. And I've got a perfect example today. And it's written by my friends at WWeek.com. They tend to tilt a little bit to the left, especially some of their writers tend to take a left-wing point of view. And that goes double for somebody like a writer like Sophie Peel. She's just written a story about a strike by Nabisco workers. Now, they were striking across the country. They were also striking here in the Pacific Northwest at the Nabisco factory in Northeast Portland. And the beginning of the story says, the month-long strike by the Bakers Union at the Nabisco family came to an end on Saturday against the will of Portland workers when fellow Baker Union members across the country overwhelmingly voted in favor of adopting the proposed contract. The union reps and Mondelez International, the owners of Nabisco, had struck during bargaining. Most Portland members of the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union Local 364 that struck the bakery, about 200 of them, voted against the contract. Now, this is where we get to where one of my objections to unions. If you are somebody who works without a union contract, if you work in a right-to-work state, Idaho is, Oregon and Washington are not. Oregon and Washington are not right-to-work states. If you go to work in a union workplace, you have to join the union. You have no choice about it. I was in that position at one point. I didn't like it. So these union workers say, but we voted against the contract. Well, guess what, sweetheart? You agreed to be part of a union. That is, you submitted your will. You gave up your sovereignty as an individual worker to your union bosses. And when your union bosses say, well, we agreed to the contract, or union workers elsewhere in America say, we signed off on the contract, I don't know what's wrong with you, you gave up that freedom. And now you're griping about it, saying, well, we voted it down. Yes, but you're part of a union. So you're subject to the will of people who don't even live anywhere near where you live, who don't work next to you. Now, They voted against it. They were unhappy with how to propose creating weekend crews that would take away most weekend overtime opportunities for the folks, the men and women who work during the week. The contract does, however, keep the health care plan from the previous contract, which expired this summer, and union members wanted to hang on to that. Local union reps told Willamette Week that both new and existing employees could bid for the contested weekend shifts, and those workers would have three 12-hour shifts, but they'd get paid for 40 hours. Portland union members say that's no better than the last offer. Well, guess what? You joined a union. If you didn't work for a union, if you weren't a union member, you could say, that's not good enough. I'm not going to work under those conditions. But you can't have it both ways. You can't say, I want all the advantages of working under a union, and I get those advantages, and then say, but I don't like it when the union makes a deal for us. Well, you gave up that sovereignty. Not only did you give it up, but you have to pay union dues to be part of it. So you get screwed two ways. So once again, this is one of the reasons that I think unions don't make any sense for most people who have good skills. And unfortunately, these people are all, you know, PO'd about the fact that they have to go along with a contract. Hey, you wanted to be part of a union? You're there. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Our Twitter poll today, should Northwest states give parents and students choice when it comes to public schools? That is, should the dollars follow your child to wherever you want to take them? You don't have to take them to the government-run schools that are currently failing kids. You could take your dollars to a charter school, a public school, or a private charter school. You could do any of those things if you choose to, but you don't have that choice right now. A Real Clear Opinion research poll released about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, found that 74% of registered voters now support school choice. I think this would be a bang-up time to put an initiative petition on the ballot. One in Oregon, one in Washington, one in Idaho, and say, if you decide the public schools are failing your kids, you can take those dollars, not in actual dollars, but in the form of a voucher of one kind or another, and you could spend them at a private school, at a parochial school, on online learning, at a magnet school, at a public charter school, at a private charter school, at a traditional public school. All of a sudden, you get choice. Just like most government programs, I pointed out, if you get food stamps, you don't have to spend them at a government supermarket. There is no such thing. Imagine if you were told, when you get food stamps, you have to go to a supermarket run by Jay Inslee or Kate Brown. And you can imagine what a cluster that would be, a mess all day long. When you get Medicare or Medicaid, you don't have to spend it at a government hospital. In fact, in the Northwest, most of the hospitals are private institutions. If you have a Pell Grant, you can take it to a public university. You can take it to a private university. You don't get forced to go one place or the other. And yet, when it comes to public education, Washington State, $17,000 per kid per year. Oregon right behind it, about $16,000 per kid per year. They tell you, if you're going to get a public education, you will get it courtesy of the government. You don't have any choices at all. And that makes no sense to me. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's a pleasure to be with you. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network. Just in preparation for this interview with Mary Sterrett, who is a Yamhill County Board of Commissioners member. Mary, I think I have to go all the way back to February of this year. If somebody said, when did the government start giving you phony numbers about the COVID pandemic? I think it was February of 2020. You have to go back that far. And ever since then, I think, and I could give you the specific example, but it's not worth it today. Ever since then, people have had questions about the numbers that were fed by the government to try to describe where do we stand with COVID. And these days, why are the hospitals overrun with cases, or so we're told? And it's made me wonder, and you've raised this issue, you've suggested that in this case, the Oregon Health Authority, not the one from Washington State or the one from Idaho, but the Oregon Health Authority has been feeding out bad numbers. Welcome back to the program and tell me what you've found.
Thanks, Lars. Well, we've made a number of requests, as have Oregon Senators Linthicum and Thatcher, asking for just simple things like cycle thresholds and how they're testing people. For instance, I've made numerous requests about various data, including hospital beds and hospital usage, got no information back, got no information. Public records requests returned non-responsive, which is kind of odd. But if you think about the fact that the CDC started to monitor breakthrough cases back in January, but the Oregon Health Authority didn't even start doing that till July 24th, we sent a letter to Pat Allen, and I asked him some specific questions using OHA data. I said, it kind of looks odd here because it looks like we're seeing that could be up to 47.3% of the August COVID deaths, and at the very least, 24% were due to vaccine failure or vaccine breakthrough. So instead of answering the questions, they basically got a hold of their lapdogs at the Oregonian and said, well, we're going to just discount this without answering any of the questions. But the data is not out there. They're not using the data. They're not using clear data. And they're telling us, for instance, that that basically if you're vaccinated, you're safe. But the vaccine failure rate is way higher than we've been told.
And that's the suspicion I've had, because people say to me, Lars, you know, they'll call and say, you need to get vaccinated. Everybody should get vaccinated. It'll protect you. And I said, protect you from what? And they said, you know, from getting it or getting a serious case. And I said, do you realize that in the month of August, Oregon admits that 22% of the people who died had been vaccinated? That doesn't sound, and Friday I told a guy, it doesn't sound like a mild case to me. If you say, well, if you have the vaccine, you may still get it, but the case won't be as severe. I said, if 22% of the people who died in the month of August in one entire state had been vaccinated but still got sick enough that they died, that seems to suggest the vaccines don't work as well as we've been told.
Well, if you look at the 14,000 COVID cases from September 5th through the 11th, 14,000 cases, 2,600 of them were fully vaxxed, okay? Now when they tell us that people in the hospitals are unvaccinated, you have to remember we have three separate categories. We have a fully vaccinated person, a partially vaccinated person, and an unvaccinated person. They're skewing the data by basically saying anyone who hasn't had that second dose or is 14 days past the second dose is counted as an unvaccinated person, but they are partially vaccinated. We also know that the cycle threshold they're using to test these cases are way above 28, which is not what the diagnosis needs to be. And that is giving us a lot of false positives. They're manipulating the data, and we can't get anything clear out of them, and they won't respond to us. They just basically say, you know, across the board that anything that we say counter to what they're putting out the narrative is misinformation. And all I said was, hey, show me your work. I showed you mine using your data, and we can't even get any clear numbers out of them.
Well, and let's go back to the thing you started with. When the CDC changed its standard for so-called breakthroughs, a breakthrough is when somebody's been vaccinated and they get COVID anyway. That's called a breakthrough. CDC starts monitoring it way back in, I think you said, January. Oregon waits till July. Are the people at the Oregon Health Authority not looking at the CDC saying, well, maybe they changed the standard. Why don't we do it? And it takes them 6 months to get there. You wonder, maybe it's because they're being run by an epidemiologist who's not actually an epidemiologist, right?
Well, that could be one thing. But if you also look at it, we've got they're giving us numbers saying that what they call the sporadic rate, meaning we don't know why you caught COVID, but you caught COVID. They're saying that's 10 times higher than the household transmission, which is typically where people are catching it. Now, that is not statistically possible. And yet when you ask them about this, they say, well, you know, your numbers are inaccurate. We're just saying it's very clear that Oregon Health Authority is cooking the books here.
Well, and I'll tell you another cook the books, Mary, that I became aware of. And I said last week, I said, I'm going to cite as a source. I read a lot from both the right and the left, you know, but I factor that in. I mean, I read Willamweek. I read The Atlantic magazine, which is notoriously left wing. And yet last week they came out with a story and they said as much as 50%, this is nationwide, of the people who are hospitalized with COVID are either asymptomatic or they have mild symptoms. And I thought, You know, when I've been, I've been in the hospital since I was 16 years old. But when I've taken family members or Tina, usually they'll say, yeah, you don't need to spend the night, or just for the sake of safety, you ought to spend the night here at the hospital. But to imagine a case where they say you've tested positive for COVID, you're not very sick, you're not even showing any symptoms at all, let's book you into the hospital, you start to wonder, why are they doing that? And Mary, I'd go back to that investigative reporter rule I learned a long time ago, follow the money. 80% of hospital funding comes from elective surgery. What's happened to elective surgery? It's essentially gone at this point for a period of time. So you're the hospital CEO and you say 80% of our institution's revenue just disappeared. I still have all these bills to pay, people to pay. How do we make it up? Well, we can just stuff, you know, people in hospital beds. That's worth a couple of grand a night. And at least for a while, it's all paid for by the federal government. So there's no harm to filling every hospital bed, except then they come to us, the public, and say, our hospitals are overfilled and we're stretched to the limit. And you say, well, are you stretched to the limit because you're putting a lot of people in the hospital who aren't even sick?
Well, and then remember that a lot of the folks that are stuck in ICU beds, you know, as you mentioned, could be in a normal hospital bed and it would be fine. But we also have folks in there on psychiatric hold. We have folks in there because they can't find long-term care slots for them. We have folks in there who are just basically filling up the bed. And as you mentioned, that study that The Atlantic did said half of these people don't need to be in there, and yet they're crying, oh, our hospitals are over capacity, which is really disingenuous. But I think that basically what we're looking at here is a lack of confidence, the Oregon Health Authority, and we know that there have been public records requests that have been denied, and now we've got a grand jury federal investigation requested by two Oregon senators, hoping that some of this evidentiary material will be enough to spur an investigation.
That's right. That is the chair of the Amhill County Board of Commissioners, Mary Starrett, who is asking the hard questions. And OHA, no answers. And by the way, they won't talk to me either. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to get your phone calls from all over our broadcast territory, which is Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We call it Honestly Provocative Talk Radio. Well, last Friday, I spent some time talking to Todd Myers from the Washington Policy Center about the fact that the Washington Building Codes Council met last Friday, and they were planning to take a vote on whether or not, get this, to ban the installation of natural gas at all in all new commercial buildings. And you might say, well, if you haven't heard us talk about this before, well, why would they want to do that? Natural gas is plentiful. The price has gone up a bit this year, but it's plentiful. It's relatively inexpensive. It's clean. Well, it's not clean if you talk to the greenies, the ones who are very concerned about CO2 in the air. They would say, oh, it's cleaner than oil, but it's not clean enough for us. We want nothing that burns. They want solar and wind. Now, of course, they ignore the fact that solar and wind are the result of a manufacturing process that creates a lot of solar panels. They're good for 20 to 25 years, and then you have to take them to the landfill. There's almost no way to recycle them. The same thing with windmill blades. They ignore that as well. But let's get back to natural gas. What they want to do is force people to go all electric. Now, there have already been towns like Bellingham, Washington, that said, we want to ban natural gas in all new residential construction, all new commercial construction. And now we had the Washington Building Codes Council last Friday. And I said, this is absolute insanity to give up on a kind of fuel that is plentiful in the United States, that is clean burning, at least as burning things go. It's not coal and it's not oil. And I heard this reply from Derek Metzen, who's an architect. And he said, Lars, I heard you touch on the Washington Building Codes Council on Friday. I'm an architect in many states, including Washington. I live in Oregon. After waiting on the Building Code Council Zoom call for 2.5 hours, they started talking about prioritizing comments from Washington residents. Their attorney steps in and says, it's a public meeting, but that doesn't mean you have to take any comments at all. You may choose if and how you take comments. He said, I was reasonably irritated and I dropped off the line. Washington residents have no idea how much this is going to cost them. A draft of the letter I will be submitting is below. From Derek Matson, principal at Green Box Architecture. He said, I was surprised to learn this week the Washington Code Council was considering restricting natural gas use. 38% of the energy in buildings is from gas, and that would be what? A 15% increase in demand on the grid? Where is the additional capacity coming from? Rolling brownouts are going to be the natural result. We've seen this in Central California right now. When we design in the San Francisco Bay Area, we often hedge for this in designs with natural gas generators, but I suppose those might go by the wayside as well. Current energy code already pushes users toward heat pumps, which are effective in most cases. However, and this is an architect writing, however, the effectiveness of heat pumps diminishes at 15 degrees. It's cut in half at minus 10 degrees. So essentially, you're saying if you've got a heat pump on your house and you say it's great until the temperature drops far enough. He says limited supplemental electric heat is not going to suffice at those temperatures. And you have cities like Spokane wondering why they are left with ineffective HVAC solutions. Retrofitting many uses is not as simple as simply changing the equipment. Restaurants, for example, after we've asked them to close for the last year and a half, are we going to ask them to convert to electric appliances, change out their transformer, their SES, and their panels for the increased electric demand of electric cooking equipment? Most uses, most places, restaurants, would need to upgrade their service for the same reason. Virtually no building has the additional electrical capacity to increase electric consumption by 60%. This is coming from an architect, not from your knucklehead talk show host. Retrofitting not just the furnace, but a large part of the electrical system would be required. He goes on to write, gas consumption was relatively stagnant for decades until the EPA and most industry associations started pushing it as a clean alternative to coal power around 2008. What's going to be next? Considering fly ash in creating concrete, a toxic component? The energy code is adopted into law by reference. Those proposed changes will initiate significant shortcomings in energy management without the forethought of trying to solve them. Do not adopt the proposed changes. That's from Derek Mattson. He's the principal architect at Greenbox Architecture. Now, I always wait for the naysayers who want to call me up and tell me why we should dump natural gas. You should know the United States has more natural gas reserves today, known reserves of natural gas, than we had, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago. They found a lot of it as a result of both oil drilling and fracking that brought more natural gas to the surface. We're actually enough in surplus of natural gas that we actually ship some of it overseas. We sell it. And I know there are people who say, no, we should keep it all for ourselves. If you believe that, you don't know much about the economics of the Pacific Northwest. Most of the apples grown in Washington do not stay in Washington. And you would be killing apple growers if you said, keep all those apples for us. Don't ship any. Mexico is actually the biggest foreign consumer of Washington apples, believe it or not. So is Asia. Asia comes farther down the list. If you went to Northwest wheat growers and said to them, we want you to grow wheat, but only for consumption here in the Northwest, they'd say, you're crazy. We ship most of our wheat outside the region. We sell it to other people who want to buy it. We make a product. And not only that, it's a renewable product. I mean, this ought to make all the greenies out there very happy. You grow wheat, you sell it to a lot of people. Some of it's used in the Northwest. A lot of it is shipped elsewhere around the country and elsewhere around the world. And then we grow more of it. What's not to like about that? And then you've got natural gas. Again, it's a fossil fuel. The greenies don't like it. It does involve burning. Yes, it does. But when he says 38% of all the energy used in buildings here in the Northwest comes from natural gas, and you say, we're going to get rid of that. Well, what are we going to use instead for heating our homes, heating our businesses, and heating water for human beings to use it? And they say, oh, we're going to go all electric. Great. You mean we're already forecast a 1 in 3 chance of blackouts or brownouts in the next 2 years, and you want to add more demand? You want to add on electric cars? You want to change every restaurant? And I'll bet if you walked into a restaurant, a nice restaurant, and you said to the cook, would you rather cook food on natural gas or would you rather cook it on electric appliances? You know what's going to happen? They're going to say, I don't want to cook on electric. Electric, you know, for any serious cook out there, I'm not one, by the way, but for anybody who's out there who's a serious cook, they all say you cook on gas. And all of a sudden, the regulators are going to come in and say, you're not allowed to use that anymore. Let's go to Doug, who's listening on the Radio Northwest Network in Eugene and KPNW. Doug, what's on your mind?
Hey, they had a commentary on that. Doug Sittel, S-I-T-T-E-L, on Google. And the YouTube uploads a picture of a hand over a glass. Captioned, police admit he says who was responsible for the 9/11 terror attacks. He mentions George.
What are you talking about? You called in and told the producer you were going to talk about Canadian dairy taxes? What are you actually discussing? So the audience
Doug
knows.
Sittel, S-I-T-T-E-L, on Google, and the YouTube uploads a picture of a hand over the glass. He tells who was responsible for the terror attacks on 9/11 towers.
Hmm. So you had to lie to my producer to be able to get on the line so you could talk about 9/11 conspiracy theories. Doug, I don't take lies to the producers very lightly. That means you're not welcome here anymore. If you call in and tell the truth, we're glad to get you on. Coming up in a moment, what can businesses do to fight back against Joe Biden's vaccine demands? We're going to get to that and your phone calls and emails. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. It is not a pleasure to watch what government seems to be doing to itself and by extension to the rest of us. Let me give you an example. From my own home state of Washington State, we've got the governor telling the federal government, please send us help right now. We're short of doctors. We're short of nurses. We're short of hospital personnel. I mean, it's an abject plea for some help. The problem is, in fact, I'll read it to you. Jay Inslee has now sent a letter to the White House to the COVID response coordinator, Jeff Zients, asking for help staffing hospitals. Inslee says the surge from Delta COVID-19 variant has overwhelmed the hospitals. Now, what Governor Jay Inslee, who's supposed to be a smart guy, he's not very smart, but he's supposed to be a smart guy, doesn't mention is, by the way, I got rid of a lot of doctors and nurses by telling them either get vaccinated or get out. And I've got all these hundreds and hundreds of doctors and nurses who are saying, I'm not going to stick around for this. You are not going to make me take the vaccination. Now, whether you think that's right or wrong, do those people have a right to make that decision? To create a short... Patrick Hughes joins me now, who's the president of the Liberty Justice Center. Patrick, this sounds like Rahm Emanuel. Remember when he said, never let a good crisis go to waste? If you don't have a crisis handy, you can probably manufacture one. And it sounds like a lot of states are doing exactly that.
Well, Lars, I'm a Chicagoan, so I know Rahm Emanuel very well, and you're exactly right. And you see what the Biden administration is doing. They tried this first with the eviction moratorium, right, to overreach on what their authority is from the federal government. Now Biden wants to do vaccine mandates for even private businesses. Forget about government employees, which he's already instituted it for. Think about private businesses with businesses of over 100 employees being forced by the Biden administration to mandate vaccines or testing every week. He doesn't have the authority under OSHA like he says that he does. And you know, at Liberty Justice Center, we have clients, and we're developing more clients to, when this mandate goes into effect, to file a suit to stop the Biden administration from this constant governmental overreach that clearly trickles down to states like Illinois, where I am, and Washington, where you are.
Well, and what do we do when state authorities have created the problem to begin with by saying it is going to be an all or nothing? And a lot of these people are saying, well, I'll get a religious exemption. And apparently what the hospitals have been doing is telling nurses in particular, that I get emails almost every day from nurses who say, I got the religious exemption. And they said, fine, you can have your exemption. Oh, and by the way, we're not scheduling you for any shifts at all. Don't expect a paycheck. So they're constructively firing them, but without actually firing them. And then on the other hand, the governor who created the problem to begin with turns around and goes hat in hand to the White House saying, you've got to send us more medical personnel. We're overrun. Well, you're overrun because you ran a lot of the doctors and nurses out of the building.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, sometimes with the left, they don't understand the consequences of sort of their wish list or their actions, and they're seeing the consequences in real time. Imagine that same scenario that you just laid out there at the hospitals in Washington being played out at every company that has over 100 employees all over the country in an economy with a 5.5% inflation rate, with 11 million jobs already unfilled. And imagine what the consequences are to businesses if this vaccine mandate at the national level is allowed to go through. So these consequences are real. They don't know what they're doing. these folks are used, but whether it's Inslee or the Biden administration or our governor, Governor Pritzker in Illinois, or any of the governors in the blue states across the country are doing, is COVID's become extremely political, right? So for Biden, yep. he realizes that Afghanistan was a disaster, his immigration policies are causing the problems down in Texas, and COVID is the only thing that he polls decent on. So he's going to double down on COVID, try to use it to make him look more authoritative, a lot like that erstwhile governor in New York did before he resigned for other reasons. It's the same playbook. I finally think that the American people are, you know, being awakened to it. But more to the point, these mandates, particularly this mandate that Biden is talking about using OSHA to institute vaccines for companies with more than 100 people,
yep.
it's not allowed. The law doesn't provide for it. And so hopefully we'll be part of stopping that, but it has to stop just like the eviction moratoriums.
See, and the thing I worry about, Patrick Hughes is at the Liberty Justice Center. What I worry about is people write to me and they say, you got to do something about this. And I say, well, I can send you various places like Liberty Justice. I can send you to firstliberty.org for religious exemptions. And they say, but what happens when my boss doesn't buy those? And I say, I hate to, what I have to tell them, which I think is the honest answer, is the courts will decide it in some period of time. It could be weeks. It could be months. It could be years. And you just sit tight till that happens. Well, I know that they're not being given years to make the decision. They're being shoved out the door right now. Some of them are already effectively fired. So what do we tell these people?
It's very difficult to hold on, and that help is on the way. Like you mentioned, libertyjusticecenter.org, people can go there. They can email us at help@libertyjusticecenter.org, and if they have a claim, we'll take a look at it. And more to the point, we're going to file precedent-setting litigation on these issues across the country and get it done through the system as quickly as possible so people aren't suffering months or years. The eviction moratorium was determined pretty quickly, and we're yep. hoping that on mandates like the federal mandate that's being proposed and others, that it can move with that much speed. But Lars, well, you're absolutely right. There's real pain that people are feeling because of these terrible policy decisions.
I mean, they're taking people and telling them you're not employable in the hospital or the doctor's office where you are now. And effectively, we made you unemployable in an entire state or in some cases in an entire region, which means you're looking at telling the family, rip up your roots and move somewhere else. And if Joe's doing, and I believe you're right that he's doing this for political reasons. He's trying to say, see, I'm performing on COVID. Does he realize the kind of enmity he's going to earn from this when families 5 and 10 years from now will say, remember when Aunt Susie got fired from her nursing job and the whole family had to pick up stakes and move hundreds of miles away to try to find work in a red state instead of a blue state? And they're going to say, yep, I remember that. And they will remember it for a long, long time, even if it was only one member of their extended family.
Yeah, and the people that Aunt Susie was going to take care of that didn't get proper care, and God forbid something happened to them tragically, they're all going to remember what happened as a result of this policy, too. But in this day and age, sadly, politics rules everything. The left is, you know, their goal is to get power. They see this as a way to get power. Biden is very desperate politically, and I think this mandate is part of political desperation, and the costs that are borne by the American public are secondary in the calculation.
Well, and I think it does explain something. It's not a good explanation, but it explains something, Patrick, because I kept asking people, why do we need $3.5 trillion in new social programs and all this massive spending? We've got unemployment below 5%. We've got prices going up, which means there's demand for goods if you just produce them. Why would we need a social safety net for more people in an economy that looks like it's like a horse held back by the rider and the horse is ready to take off and run full speed? And the answer is because they're planning on destroying the economy, both hospitals, clinics, as well as retail businesses as well.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, regardless of where you are on Trump, when he was managing COVID, the whole goal, this is true of DeSantis and in Texas, the whole goal is to balance the crisis of COVID and people's health care along how do we not destroy ourselves. The Democrats have taken over in the states they're in the federal government now. That's a secondary consideration to power and politics and what the consequences of all that will be for them politically or through their own power. And that's why the decisions aren't being made for the good of the public or for economic growth. Like you said, the economy is ready to take off and they just won't let it. Biden is tied to his left-wing base and it's causing terrible crisis in the country and to everyday people, just like you said.
If you need this kind of help, Liberty Justice Center, again, there's you're a nonprofit. They'll help you out, or they'll at least point you in the right direction. Patrick Hughes is the president of the Liberty Justice Center. Glad to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. Glad to be with you and glad to have you answer our Twitter poll. We put up a brand new question made from the news of the day. Today, should Northwest states give parents and students choice when it comes to public schools? With all the trouble that the public schools have delivered over the decades with failures when it comes to teaching kids and then their performance during the COVID pandemic and all the government shutdowns was even more pathetic. Should you have the choice to take your child and take your child where you choose to have your child educated, whether it's private, parochial, online, magnet school, public charter school, traditional public school? There's a brand new poll out from Real Clear Opinion Research that finds 74% of registered voters now support school choice. But in Oregon and Washington, and I think Idaho too, you don't have school choice. If you say, I want to put my kids in a private school, and you say, can I use some of the money or all of the money that's currently allocated? In Washington State, that's $17,000 per student per year that is allocated for every single child in K through 12 education. Imagine the kind of private education you could get, or parochial education, or online education, or private charter schools. Right now, all charter schools are public. You could have private charter schools as well. And the whole system would involve competition. Now, I've always held to the belief, and I've never seen an example otherwise, that competition brings about excellence in the product, whatever the product happens to be. It could be a service as well. It also brings about the lowest possible price. The public government-run schools dominated by unions love a no-competition environment because they don't have to perform. If you make them perform, then they have to perform, and if they don't, they lose the money altogether. Let's go to Mike. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me on. I actually want to jump back to your story about Jay Inslee asking the feds for help with the doctors and nurses. I really think we're missing the point here. I mean,
what is it?
Well, I know we're getting rid of all of our medical staff that we really need, but on a positive note, we're going to keep all of our mail carriers so we always get our junk mail.
Yep, we are. Because it turns out that when Joe Biden put the mandate down for federal employees, they forgot to say on the first day, oh, by the way, we've exempted about 600,000 people who work for the U.S. Postal Service. They're exempt from the rule.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out the wisdom that the Biden administration has in selecting who they're going to exempt and who they're not. So,
that's a very good point.
Our medical...
What's that? Oh, Mike, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Here are the details. Washington Governor Jay Inslee, this was released today, about an hour ago. He says so far the Washington State Department of Health has requested 1,200 clinical and non-clinical staff from the federal government. Now, if you're one of those doctors or nurses who got told, take the jab or lose your job, how do you feel about the fact that Jay Inslee is now saying to the federal government, we'd like you to send more doctors and nurses. We've run short. They've run short because they decided to send a bunch of doctors and nurses out the door. Let's go to Phil in the Tri-Cities, listening on the great KONA and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the show. Just a quick point. It's interesting that they say these hospitals are overrun. I can tell you factually that is not true. Cadillac in particular. Doing electrical work, inspecting electrical work, there are empty beds everywhere. They're overrun because they're short-staffed because the staff has quit.
Yep.
Number two, my sister-in-law, who is a nurse, her boss got a letter from Mr. Inslee's office saying, if you don't get the vaccine, we will take your license. How pathetic is that?
It's very pathetic because, Phil, they're essentially destroying people's careers. In some cases, as I said, you have to imagine this not just at the state mandate level, but imagine what it does to the individual. So, mom comes home and mom is a nurse or mom is a doctor. And she says to the family, I know dad's got a great job here, but I just lost my job and we can't do it on one paycheck. We're going to have to leave not just the state, either the state of Oregon or the state of Washington. We're going to have to leave the region. The closest we can go to is Idaho or perhaps Nevada, certainly not California. And so you tell an entire family, rip up stakes, sell your house, and run to another state where they're not going to treat you like this. Imagine the kind of damage you're going to do to people and their families.
Well, it's important to note, too, that, you know, back to women's choice. It's they want to get an abortion, fine. Well, you don't want the COVID shot? No, that's where do you draw the line in the sand, you know?
Well, and you're right about that, because the our bodies, our choice crowd disappeared the minute Joe Biden started laying down mandates, the minute people like Kate Brown and Jay Inslee as governors of Oregon and Washington laid down mandates, all of a sudden they were nowhere to be found. But they'll tell you all day long, if a 16-year-old girl wants an abortion, she has a right to get one, or she has a right not to get one. If she wants birth control pills, she can have them or not have them. And if she wants to change from one gender to another, they would argue that you have to give them that gender change treatment, even though they're not even of age. And it may cause permanent changes in them that they may regret when they get the maturity that they may get in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years. And yet those kinds of things are allowed to be an individual choice. And yet when it comes to the vaccine, you get no individual choice at all. If that makes sense to any of you, I'd love to hear the naysayer call. I'd love to hear somebody argue. You have no right to decide for yourself whether or not you get a vaccine. And if you don't get it, they can take away your job. They can take away your career. As you pointed out, they can take away your license to even be in your career. All of that. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. And this segment is brought to you by Nick Shivers at nickshivers.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. It is serving the Pacific Northwest with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And of course, you're welcome to join the conversation at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Over the last year and a half, there's been a lot of discussion about the so-called emergency powers of people like the governor of Oregon and the governor of Washington, because I think that both Kate Brown and Jay Inslee have seriously exceeded their authority in doing this. They have not turned to the people's representatives and said, well, I'd like these authorities, but I need to ask the people's representatives if they're okay with that. I thought we'd talk about that with Jason Mercier, who's director of the Center for Government Reform of the Washington Policy Center. Hey, Jason, welcome back to the program. And there doesn't seem to be any effort from the Democrats on Jay Inslee's side of the aisle or from the Democrats on Kate Brown's side of the aisle to say, you can't do all this stuff without talking to the representatives of the people first at the legislature. Why not?
Yeah, Lars, thanks for having me on. You know, I need to make a little distinction. We have seen bipartisan bills. We have seen bills sponsored by Republicans and Democrats, at least in Washington State, that would just do the same thing that exists in most of the rest of the country, and that's after a certain amount of time, the executive branch has to go back to the people's representative legislative branch of government to check in and get permission and get some feedback. The problem, though, is the legislative leadership of the majority party just has not been willing to govern, to take on that responsibility, and has kept these reform bills from moving forward.
Yeah, but why? I mean, what most of the time, Jason, most of the people I've ever met who wanted to serve in public office, I've never had been bitten by the bug, but there are people who love it. And you say, why do you want to do that? Because I want to be part of, you know, making solutions, or I want to help call the shots. And we understand that somebody runs for the school board or the city council or the county commission or the legislature, and they say, we want to be part of making those big decisions. Well, you've now got the reins. You're sitting on top of the horse. What are you going to do with it? And they say, oh, no, I don't want to be in charge. I want somebody else to do it. What the heck?
You know, I really wish I could answer that question. And it's something that's been driving me crazy every single day here for almost a year. Why doesn't the legislative branch of government want to govern? The reality is, both in Oregon and Washington, with the political makeup of the legislature, more likely than not, a majority of the policies that the governors of both states want to have imposed would be ratified by the legislature. It's not like it would undo the type of policies that are being implemented. It just would be done the way it's supposed to be.
Well, it, with one little difference, Jason, and this is where I'm going to call it political cowardice. I'm not going to ask you to do that. But my attitude is you're in charge. You've got one vote in either one of the two houses of the legislature in Oregon and Washington. And you say, well, why don't you vote for this? Vote that Jay actually has all this amazing authority. Why don't you do that? I think it's cowardice because they say, yeah, I want him to have it, but I don't want to put my name on it. I don't want to put a vote toward it, because if I do that, then they own some of the responsibility for the consequences. And right now, the consequences are pretty darned ugly. So I think they'd rather just let Jay do it, because then he doesn't get called by his own party saying, no, 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 you're going too far, Inslee, or the same thing for Kate Brown. And none of the people in the legislature who like having the title senator this or representative that, and they have the office and the staff, and they get to send stuff out on letterhead, and they get to feel important, but do they actually want to feel responsible for what was done? No, no, no. I want to be in charge of the ship, but when the ship runs onto the rocks, I don't want them to look at me.
Yeah, there's a very easy solution for those that don't want the responsibility and the power of being a lawmaker. Get out of the legislature. But we as a citizenry expect a representative form of government. We are not supposed to be governed by press conference, wondering, well, what's going to happen next? There's a reason why we have legislators. We have public hearings. We have public process. It's to perfect and provide that input. Would you still see people upset about the policies? Probably. But yeah, at least they would feel like they had a chance to be part of their own governance.
Well, and the other thing is, Jason, I've never been an elective office. Within my profession, I served on boards of directors for things like Society of Professional Journalists. I've done that a few times, not anymore. I've done it on the AP Board of Directors for the Associated Press. And you would come in with an idea and say that this is a great idea. And then your other board members would say, yeah, you got to fix this or fix that. And by the time it was done getting a lot of other input from people with a different point of view, you usually had a better solution. So if you had one person, a dictator like Kate Brown or Jay Inslee, and they say, this is how it's going to be, and they don't have anybody saying, hold on a second, it would be better if you limited it this way or limited it that way, you fine-tune those solutions. When you have a solution coming out of one single individual who feels that he or she is not even answerable to the public, you tend to get solutions that aren't nearly as good as if you had even a dozen other people involved in having input. Say, do it that way, but not so much, and fine tune it. Jay Inslee and Kate Brown are not getting that kind of fine tuning. So what does Washington Policy Center propose in the way that things ought to be reformed?
Just something very simple. I don't care if it's 14 days, 30 days, 45 days, or 60 days. At some point, the executive branch has to receive permission and approval from the legislative branch to execute policies. They are not charged with lawmaking. They are charged with implementing what the legislature authorizes. So we just need to have the requirement that there is not an indefinite, unlimited ability for one individual behind closed doors to call a press conference and change the entire regulatory scheme of the state without any type of legislative involvement.
Is there any way that you can get, I mean, it's going to take both Republicans and Democrats to get this through the legislature, isn't it? Because you're not going to get it through with just one party. Can you get a bipartisan group to say, yeah, that's the way it ought to be? The governor can have emergency powers given a circumstance, but they only last 30 days or 60 days. Can you get a majority behind that? Because it seems really reasonable.
I think the votes are there. We had bipartisan bills, and if they had come to the floor, I am certain they would have passed. But again, the legislative leadership, the Speaker of the House, the Senate Majority Leader would not allow those bills to move. Now, the reality, though, with our governor, he's probably going to veto it. So you're going to need to make sure you have a veto-proof majority to make sure these reforms stay in place.
But what does that say if somebody, I know you're governor, but if you're governor and a bill comes in from the people's representatives that says, your power has some limits to it, like all power. I mean, even powers of judges and juries and all that has some limitations. If you say, no, I'm rejecting it, I will not agree to that, that does something to Jay Inslee and Kate Brown, doesn't it?
Well, and that's where this mindset is very troubling. You should have emergency powers for a very short, finite period while the legislature branch has a chance to convene and figure out what to do. The thought process that this should be indefinite, unlimited, and only the governor can determine when and where they cease to exist, power is not self-limiting. This is why we need the legislation to reassert itself.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I could get some of the leadership on, I'd love to have both the Republicans and the Democrats come on and explain why shouldn't that be the case. Jason, thanks very much. I appreciate your time. That's Jason Mercier from the Washington Policy Center. Coming up in a moment, your phone calls, emails, a good naysayer, and now Seattle wants another $50 million for the city's 10,000 homeless. Are you kidding me? Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Our Twitter poll today has to do with school choice, and it's framed this way. Should Northwest states give parents and students choice when it comes to public schools? If you don't want your child in the conventional and failing bricks and mortar schools run by the state governments of Oregon and Washington, should you be able to take your child somewhere else and let the dollars follow the child? To a parochial school or a private school or online learning or magnet schools or public charter schools or the traditional public school if you choose. Sounds like a great choice to me. And why wouldn't Americans want that kind of choice? And don't you think it would drive excellence? It's the last thing I thought I would get a naysayer on, and yet there's Travis. Travis, you're a naysayer on school choice. Welcome to the program and tell me what you and I disagree about today.
Hey, Lars. Hey, trying to call myself a naysayer because I normally am not. Okay. My only personal experience with this is the public charter school.
Yeah.
And my kid did go to a smaller public charter, or it used to be a regular public school. Same school I went to, graduated from in 2000. Dad graduated there from 1969. Somewhere after 2000, it became a public charter school because they are trying to bring in as many kids as possible. There's only so many kids in the small area we live in, so they're bringing them in from town, and they're bussing them in from town. So
and
here's the thing.
What's wrong with that?
What happens when a school that I went to with 600 kids grows to 1,000, then it grows to 1,200, then it grows to 1,500, and it's built for 600?
What happens then is you build new buildings. In other words, who gets stuck with that? The same taxpayers, most of whom are not parents, that normally get stuck with it. You've got a fair amount of funding that comes from the state. The state's overall budget, I think, is about $22 billion. That's the general fund. And about half of that goes for public education. So there's $10 billion. And the community can then say, no, we're not building any more school space. And that pretty well settles that. So it's up to the voters who are living in that area to decide whether or not they want to fund that or not. And Travis, it has benefits on one hand. I mean, if you could say, I have a house, but I bought it when we had crappy schools. Now we have this school that everybody and their brother wants to send their kid to, and the community has supported it. Do you think your house is worth more or less with the best schools in the state sitting nearby?
I live a little farther away from the school, so it's not really affecting my house value. The people that live closer to the school, it's definitely helping their house value.
I'm not just talking about down the street. Because, Travis, remember, one of the key things people look for, I mean, with real estate, it's all location, location, location. But why do people say, we have school-age kids, when we move somewhere, unless you're a really bad parent, you say, we care about where we're putting our kids in school. So people who buy homes in a community for the, 18 years or so the kids are in school are going to want to buy near a good school. It doesn't matter if it's a mile away, as long as you're in that school district. I mean, Travis, there were people, and I'll bet this happens in Bellevue. I'll bet it happens in Kirkland. I know it happens in Lake Oswego and West Lynn. People say, we're going to move to West Lynn. Why? Because the schools are really good there and we want our kids in that good school. So that phenomena has a benefit. It has a benefit because it benefits people who run businesses, who have homes, and all the rest of that. But your community can decide, no, we're not putting up, $50 million to build a new high school. But, Travis, once you get competition, if you're seeing your school overrun, why would, there are times where people say, when I lived in Tillamook, there was one fast food place in the entire town. It was called the Swiss Chalet. It was a little teeny tiny place. It was run by a family. But if you wanted to go get a burger and fries, that was the only place to do it other than a conventional restaurant, right? And today you drive down there, they got Taco Bell, they got McDonald's, they got Burger King, they got the Swiss Chalet is still there. So when there's only one game in town, that's all you get. And you get whatever they shovel out to you. Now, actually, they did a fairly good job. But in most cases, people who have no competition don't exactly produce the best product. If you're a diesel shop in a small community and you're the only place that fixes diesel trucks, you know, everybody may gripe about you, but they say, if you got a diesel truck, this is the only place within 50 miles you can get it fixed. You see what happens then?
Yeah, here's what you're missing, though. So this was a public school.
Well, charter schools are public schools.
No, but I know. But here, listen to me out, because you keep saying the difference. There's no difference between a public brand school and a public charter school. It's the same thing besides the name change.
No. That is absolute. Can I tell you? Can I tell you why it's not true? I'll tell you. There's a very simple reason. If there's a business in town, everybody says that place is crap. I'm not going there to do business. What happens to the business?
But this is the only school
hold on, Travis.
There will never be another school in town.
Travis, I get that. There may be. Because once you have charter schools, somebody will say, well, we can do a charter school that's better or it's specialized. The first charter schools in America were in Arizona, and they were put together by the parents of disabled kids for the most part, who said, if you're spending all that money on...
town in Arizona?
What? It doesn't matter what town it was. What happened, Travis, was a bunch of parents got together and they said, the public schools are not serving our disabled kids well. If we had that money and could hire teachers, we could do a better job. So they created a charter school that was specifically aimed at disabled kids. You might have another charter school. There's one in Eugene that's built around more of a vocational education model. It's a high school. And they say, we're going to teach kids how to fix bicycles. And you're like, well, what can you build in? You can build everything. You can build history, math, science, reading, and everything else. And you get the kid who's not going off to a four-year college, but he may say, I want to learn how to do mechanic work. Where can I do that? Well, that charter school does a really good job. But here's the key thing that makes them different. Travis, if a public school fails, does the public school go out of business?
No, they'll keep finding tax money.
Now, you know what happens to a charter school that does not meet the conditions of its charter? It ceases to exist. It goes out of business. Yeah. Like here in the private sector, where if you have a hardware store and you give crappy service and you never have enough stock and everything else, at some point the hardware store goes out of business or it changes hands. Yeah. And somebody who knows how to run a hardware store will come in and run it and run it successfully. But with the public schools...
I run a business. I know what you mean, yeah.
Well, and so you get it. So in a public school...
Yeah, but the problem, see, so let me explain a little more here. So the original superintendent who's not there anymore that started the charter, it was originally brought in as a revenue source for the school district. Because guess what? How much money comes in with every kid?
Well, in charter schools, 80%.
But
what happens is, Travis, if you have a school district, I know of one school district, I spoke at their commencement in Monument, Oregon, right? They had a graduating class of four. So they had four kids in the graduating class. It's very tiny. Yeah. Do you think it's less expensive to run a really teeny tiny school district or more expensive?
It pretty much washes out.
No, it does not. The economies of scale that you get by having a good sized school will save you money all day long if you know how to budget. A really big school district can be run very inexpensively. A teeny tiny one that has a graduating class of four, that one's really expensive to run. Coming up, does a Biden presidency mean strong diplomacy? We're going to talk about that coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Well, I thought that Donald Trump did a great job of foreign policy. Of course, all the folks on the left said, oh, no, our enemies love us and our friends hate us. And then came Joe Biden, who seems to have not done very well at all. He made France mad last week by pulling the plug on a $90 billion nuclear reactor, nuclear sub deal. He screwed up the the evacuation of Afghanistan, the evacuation of at least Americans from Afghanistan. And of course, there's still the question, although it's not getting as much press these days, of what he's going to do with North Korea, which is still a problem. So I thought we'd talk with Jessica Lee about that, senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Jessica, good to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how are we doing, North Korea? I know there's so much else, so many other things on the agenda right now that it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. That and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's latest dress condemning the rich. But because, you know, that's more important than whether or not the crazy man in North Korea has nuclear weapons. But where's North Korea headed right now?
Well, I would say right now what we're seeing is a slow moving crisis. You know, 3 weeks ago, we learned that North Korea has resumed a key nuclear facility back in July of this summer, breaking a long hiatus that had been in place since December 2018. And the former director of Los Alamos National Laboratory, Dr. Sig Hecker, who visited this facility back in 2010, described this place as sort of the heart of North Korea's nuclear material production. So it's not good that it's resuming, you know, despite this break. And last week, North Korea launched two ballistic missiles off of its east coast, which marked the first ballistic missile test in 6 months in direct violation of UN Security Council resolutions. And then on top of that, on the same day, South Korea conducted a submarine-launched ballistic missile test, making it only the seventh country in the world to operate such missiles after U.S., Russia, China, Britain, France, and India. So all of this, like you said, comes at a time when the Biden administration seems clearly preoccupied with Afghanistan, COVID pandemic. And so this increased tensions between the two Koreas really couldn't come at a worse time.
No, and in fact, you said the facility they fired back up is this graphite moderated reactor. This kind of reminds me of reading atomic bomb history, where you go back to, what was it, the University of Chicago, where they built it under the athletic facility or something, and they had a graphite reactor that was used to produce some of the first reactions that they ever got that then led them right to the nuclear weapon. Is that where North Korea is back in the 1940s or 30s, late 30s?
Well, you know, the part of the problem, of course, is that we don't really know. You know, they could be building as many as 20 to 60 nuclear weapons. It's a big question mark as to their true capacity. And so this is why this is such a dangerous situation. And as you know, we don't currently have any relations with North Korea to be able to talk to their government leaders, get a sense from civil society, not that such, you know, thing exists in, you know, what is essentially a closed totalitarian state. So this really begs the question of, okay, if this country we know so little about is building up all of these nuclear weapons, and keep in mind, North Korea called the United States its biggest enemy, and it sees us as an existential threat. So this really becomes a big, you know, challenge for the Biden administration. And it's no wonder during, you know, his first press conference, President Biden said North Korea is actually his foreign policy priority, too, sort of like what, you know, President Obama warned. And so, you know, to your earlier point about President Trump, you know, one of the things that he did very well was to break all of the conventions of U.S.-North Korea diplomacy and say, look, I'm going to negotiate at the highest level, because in North Korea, Kim Jong-un ultimately have to sign off on anything. And I'm going to do this despite the, you know, the pushback from the establishment saying, well, you know, you're rewarding bad behavior by giving him summits. And what happened, you know, during this very public and high profile summit diplomacy was that we got to know more about, you know, what North Korea wants. And it wanted partial sanctions relief in exchange for things like, you know, closing Yongbyon, which, as I said at the top, you know, it's restarted. So there were some good things that came out of it. Now, the bad thing, of course, was that we never really sort of got closure on some of these big picture agreements between the two governments at that time. And so now we're seeing, with the change of government in Washington, you know, sort of a starting back to zero, when really we should just be building upon the work that was done by the previous administration.
Now, let me ask you this. This is Jessica Lee, who's a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute. I think the other big difference between Trump and Biden is that Trump was tough. And some of the rhetoric got ridiculed, as in, you know, Kim Jong-un says, I've got a button, and Trump says, I've got a button, and it's a lot bigger and more accurate than yours. Ha, ha, ha. But we've got Joe Biden, who leaves Afghanistan. there are still Americans, as I understand it, right now on the ground in Afghanistan who want out of there. He promised not to leave without them. He left without them. He left piles of military equipment, very valuable stuff and very dangerous stuff, in the hands of a terrorist organization. He seems, at least from my point of view, to communicate weakness all day long and twice on Sunday. Is that going to work with players like Kim Jong-un?
Well, I think, you know, on Afghanistan, President Biden had a really difficult choice. You know, does he keep going down this path where we're clearly not winning? Or does he, you know, withdraw troops and not put American lives in harm's way? And I think it was a very tough call. But, you know, to your question, you know, one of the first things you learn in negotiations 101 is that in order to reach an agreement with a party you don't agree with is to really separate the people from the problem and invest in options that will create mutual gain, right? And to have as much as possible objective criteria so that both sides feel like they're having sort of their fair, you know, share of, you know, public scrutiny. But the problem with the United States and North Korea negotiations over the last 30 years is that both sides have really broken and violated a lot of these requirements, which has led to past agreements not sticking. And so I think part of what we need to do is to really overcome our own biases and for North Korea to overcome their skepticism and their paranoia so that we can de-escalate tension, because the path that we're currently on isn't going to be working. It's certainly not what American people want in terms of, you know, getting dragged into a conflict in Asia. And it's certainly not something that we should even contemplate as being possible, because if we're going to go into North Korea to try to, you know, get rid of all their nukes, we're going to first need to identify where they are. And we don't even know where the nuclear weapons are. So we have a long way to go to have a functioning relationship where we can eventually get to some of these bigger problems like nukes. But for now, both sides just, you know, have zero trust in each other. And so these provocations and things like this that is happening could really escalate to a territory nobody wants to be in, because nobody will win. So that's, I think, where we are right now.
I agree. And Jessica, the other thing, and you can tell this is a layperson question, but when we talk about dealing at lower levels first, having some of the 30,000 people at the State Department sit down and have little talks and kind of work your way up to when the leaders get together and actually do it, it works with every other country. But in North Korea, are there any lower levels below Kim Jong-un? Because the U.S. does have that. We have a president. We got a secretary of state. We got a whole ton of people at the State Department. Kim Jong-un is the whole deal, isn't he?
Well, he is ultimately in charge. You're absolutely right. And because he doesn't allow for political dissent, the power is definitely concentrated at the top. At the same time, they do have a foreign ministry and a bureaucracy. That's not to say that Kim Jong-un is beholden to, you know, someone more junior than him, a bureaucrat, to dictate, you know, this most critical relationship, you know, that it has to manage. But, you know, Kim Jong-un does have ultimate power and control. And so, you know, I think this goes back to sort of how do we understand North Korea's motive and intentions? Do we really understand why Kim Jong-un is doing what it's doing? And once we let go of our own sort of biases that, you know, Kim Jong-un can't be trusted, he's a dictator and a human rights violator and all of these other things that, frankly, other countries that we have relations with also deal with.
Absolutely right. That's Jessica Lee from the Quincy Institute. Jessica, thanks so very much. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. And of course, it's my pleasure to be with you. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. They'll give you the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Visit online or visit one of their three physical locations, MarqueeHotTubs.com. Let's go first to Chris, who's calling in, listening on the Radio Northwest Network in Coos Bay. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I want to go back to 1966. Can you remember that far back?
Let's see. I would have been 7 years old, so yes, I
did. Well, then, I finished my senior year in Orange County at a newly created style high school called Continuation High School. Uh-huh. So you probably aren't familiar with that term.
No, I'm not. Was it a trade school or they have things called skills center today.
Yeah. Huh?
They have things called skills centers today that are more aimed at a vocational education.
Well, Can I just tell you a bit about this one?
Well, you know, I want you to get to your point, Chris, because there are other people waiting, and I figured you had a point about charter schools, but you've taken us back 70 years, 60 years anyway.
I just wanted to say it's good that it evolved, because what I had to go through was not fun, and so people should be very appreciative of the charter schools that we have nowadays. Because being in a continuation school, for one reason or another, usually it was bad boys or girls that had children out of wedlock, such as me. That was it. But now it's better, and I just hope people can appreciate it. And
I hope they do too, Chris. Because
take hold, and families can have the money to fund their children to go there.
I think that's why school vouchers are now so popular. 74% of registered voters in the Northwest support school choice, and that's what that's all about. Let's go to Tim, who's in Canada. Tim, some of your countrymen were being disparaged earlier today, so I hope you're all right with that.
Oh, yeah, we're okay. We're okay. It is election day, so it is kind of crazy over here. I was just going to sort of give you a little bit of an idea of exactly how this is working. We have unelected officials, health authority, they're calling them, making rules that have no basis in science, which they admit. They'll say, you know, we're only allowing this number of people at this place and this number of people at this place because this is what we're going to do. And at this point, if you're not vaccinated, you can't go to a funeral or a wedding or eat out. And there's premiers promising, you know, we won't put in a vaccine passport. We won't do it. And then all of a sudden they do. And it's like, it's temporary. No, it's not. It's not temporary. It's going to go national. It's communism. It's scary. I've got kids, and I'm just so terrified for their future.
I'm with you. Do you remember 15 days to flatten the curve? I mean, it was a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
So it's do you remember that?
Yeah. I do. Do you know what the hardest part of 15 days to flatten the curve is?
The next 18 months. And Tim, this is, look, I understand that when you're dealing with something that's something we've never really dealt with before, that you're going to have to expect that some things are going to have to make them up as you go along. But on the other hand, like you said, you get assurances that this is going to happen. And then they say, sorry, we changed our mind. And changing their mind at the last minute or the last second, saying, oh, by the way, you thought you're sending your kids to school today? Well, you're not. You thought you were reopening your business? Well, you're not. You thought you were going back to work? Get a vaccine or you lose your job. What? Where did that come from? Oh, and by the way, we won't give you any unemployment.
It's all under the guise of our safety. And where have we heard that before, Lars? I mean, history is sort of not exactly repeating itself, but we've seen this before in history. It's for your safety. It's for your safety. No, it's not. It's not for
And you're right. It is about communism because, Tim, I've heard the word fascist used so many times in the last 18 months, and most people don't know what a fascist is. A fascist believes the group comes first, the individual comes last. In America, we are unique in the world. I mean, God bless the Canadians, but even you don't have the God-given rights that we have because our Constitution says people get these rights from God. The Constitution is there to keep the government from trampling all over them. But having said that, if you say, well, hold on, you mean the rights of the individual come first always? And I always use the example, it's great with the Gabby Petito case in the news right now. If, for example, we find out that her fiance actually killed her, which I think is probably Occam's razor says that's probably who probably, you know, did either knows what happened to her or he actually killed her. If we violate his rights as a citizen, we have to let him walk. Now, they try not to let that happen, but that's how seriously we take individual rights. You say, hold on, we're going to let a killer walk because we violated his rights? You go, how is that good for the group? And the answer is, it doesn't have to be good for the group. Our Constitution says the rights of the individual are paramount, and what's good for the group may or may not happen. But if you treat everyone that way and you say every single individual citizen in our country has individual rights and the government shall not interfere with them, and if they do, we may have to do things like letting a killer or a rapist walk away. And you say, well, it's terrible. You say, no, it's saying to the government, do your job correctly, do not violate individual rights. The folks who say you have to get the vaccine, it's good for the rest of us, those people are the real fascists. And as you said, I think you're right. It is on the path to communism, and it's not going to be a fun path. If you think it is, tell me a successful communist country somewhere on earth and explain Cuba and Venezuela, too. You got the Lars Larson Show.